As we've seen on this show, all kinds of people can find success. Did you know that 34% of tech professionals don't have a bachelor's degree? Skills First Hiring isn't just inclusive, it is the smart strategy to expand your tech talent pipeline. And finding the right tech talent isn't just hard, it's mission critical. And yet many enterprise employers still rely on outdated methods or platforms that just don't deliver. In today's market, hiring tech professionals isn't just about filling roles, it's about outpacing competitors. But with niche skills, hybrid preferences, and high salary expectations, it's never been more challenging to cut through the noise and connect with the right people. And that's where Indeed comes in. Indeed isn't just a job board, it is your tech hiring partner. As a number one site where tech talent applies to jobs, Indeed gives you direct access to over 3 million U.S. tech professionals, 86% of whom have applied through the platform. So post your first job and get $75 off at Indeed.com/tech talent. That's Indeed.com/tech talent to claim this offer. Indeed, built for what's now and what's next in tech hiring. Looking to diversify your business portfolio with a high growth opportunity? Discover Mathnasium Learning Centers, the number one math-only education franchise. For more than 20 years, Mathnasium has triumphed in a booming multi-billion dollar tutoring industry with over 1,200 centers worldwide. Ranked on Entrepreneur's Franchise 500 list for 11 consecutive years, Mathnasium is low-cost, recession-resistant, and offers significant growth potential in an expanding market. The demand for math education is skyrocketing, driven by declining math scores and the growing need for STEM skills in today's workforce. What makes Mathnasium a smart investment? Affordable entry point and quick build-out time. High-earning centers with seven-figure annual revenue, industry-leading 30% plus average profit margins, and it's a trusted brand with high consumer satisfaction scores. And here's something extra. They're offering a 25% discount on the franchise fee for former teachers and veterans. So whether you're expanding your franchise portfolio or making your first investment, Mathnasium gives you the systems and support you need to succeed. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604.
An editor could have been perfectly within their rights to come back to me and say, this is appalling. You know, and I think that I have a certain ability to sort of separate myself from the anxiety that you might have turning in a piece with a lead that might stop you in your tracks.
Hey everyone, welcome to How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at Entrepreneur.com. Today we have a guest who is very successful and just published a book about how it happened. So everything is really coming together on our show, How Success Happens, right now. Susan Arlene is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. She's also the author of multiple best-selling books, including The Orchid Thief, which was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film adaptation. And she's got a new one out now, Joyride, which I began reading and I was loving it. And then I slammed it shut, and I'll explain why in a second. Welcome, Susan.
So happy to be with you.
Great to talk to you. So yes, I was reading your book and, as I said, really loving it. And then on page 47, you explain that you don't like to prepare for interviews all that much. You don't like to cloud your head with too much research. And I thought, who the hell am I to disregard Susan Arlene's advice? So I closed the book. So the last thing I was reading, you were writing for an alt weekly. Did anything interesting happen after that?
Nope, that's it. My career, okay. My career came to a screeching halt at that moment. And the rest of the book is blank pages.
Yeah, okay. I really did stop reading it, but I'm really anxious to get back to it because you've just done so many incredible things. And I think whether you are a journalist or not, it's hard not to envy, you know, what you've been able to accomplish over the years and these incredible stories that you were able to find. So I guess I wanted to start by asking you, you've done a lot of such different things. Like, how do you decide what you're going to do next?
That's a great question. It is a big part of being self-employed, which is the case for many writers. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, but I'm still essentially self-directed and self-employed. So each choice about what I do really is a choice that I'm making. And I don't have an agenda. I don't finish one project and think, now I want to do something quite different, or, you know, I don't plot it out in that way. I tend to like mixing up the duration of the project. You know, it's nice to go from a very long project to doing something shorter, get a little more immediate gratification, turn something around a little more quickly. But, you know, stories fall into your lap kind of as they happen. And you can't always predict whether you're going to stumble into something immediately that's going to turn into another very big project right after you finish a big project. You know, you just don't know. I like being busy. So if I have not done, if I finished one project, I'm usually kind of hankering for what I'm going to do next. So I'm more open to ideas and my brain is kind of working in that mode of what would be an interesting story to work on next.
Do you have any, I just finished my book traditions, like I typed the end, I sent it off, I'm done with it? Is there any way you celebrate or anything you do?
Well, on one book, I got a tattoo. I felt like that was a nice kind of marking of the end of the book. And I thought about doing that again when I finished Joyride, but I thought I don't want to be a person who has a million tattoos. So I don't know if that's the best tradition, but at the time that I finished that book, it really spoke to me as kind of a great way to commemorate finishing the book. You know, it's interesting because there's the day you hit send, when you send your publisher your completed manuscript, but that's just the beginning. You then do your edit, then you do your copy edits, then you do your fact checking. There are so many moments along the way. And then, you know, I suppose the real moment that feels like you finish is when you get the finished book for the right first time. And that is so ceremonial in itself that you don't feel a great need to do something in addition.
Right.
You open the box, you see the books, there it is, this thing that really got made. And it's a very thrilling moment. I mean, it really is like the baby is born.
Right. That's fantastic. So when you get edits, I'm just curious, as someone who's gotten edits in my lifetime, are you the type of person who gets an edit and says, huh, that's an interesting thought? Or are you the type of person who's like, fuck you, who are you to tell me what to write?
Well, I think I'm a little biased in this regard. I think people who think that editing has ruined their deathless prose are probably not very sophisticated writers.
Right.
I would say I have generally found that, you know, I've worked with really good editors.
Yeah.
And they've come with suggestions that, the thing is that my editors respect what I'm trying to do. They are not trying to reshape my work in their image. They aren't trying to impose their style and their taste on my work. They tend to edit for clarity, for to make what I'm trying to do better. So I usually welcome it, and they are open to discussion and debate, and for me to push back and say I like it better the way I did it. But I find it the sign of maturity in your work that you can look at an editor as a really good reader who is saying, I don't understand this point, or you're repeating yourself, or I want more of this and less of that. It's a reader who is responding. And so to me, it's always got validity.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great and very healthy and very mature. So, so there's so many parallels to for Endeavor writing a book versus, you know, launching a business or any other creative endeavor. And, you know, one of the biggest questions that we face, that we get all the time at Entrepreneur, is people wondering, like, how do I know this idea is worth the time and effort I'm about to put into it? And there's no one answer to it, but I'm curious for you, you know, a book is not something that you do in a couple of weeks. Are there any signs to you that, like, I'm onto something, or are there ever signs that you're like, this isn't worth pursuing anymore?
I think this is probably the single most important instinct you can have and hopefully develop, because a book is something that you're talking about investing years. A business is something where you're talking about investing huge amounts of time and money. And you know, many book ideas in, you know, have an immediate appeal. You hear the idea, you have a gut reaction. Oh, this is so interesting. This would make a great book. What I do, and this is what people always say about shopping online, is don't do it immediately. Put it out of your head, push it away, force yourself to forget about it. Does it come back? Does it keep surfacing? Do you keep returning to the idea? Does it keep nagging at you? And I think the other thing that's really important is, would you read this book? Would you be... you know, would you find this, not as a writer, but as a reader, would this appeal to you? Would this have, you know, draw you in? And I think it's also important to know that there will be points along the way that you lose your confidence and you begin thinking, look, this isn't maybe as good an idea as I thought. That is a natural part of the process, and I don't think you want to give up the minute that you have that loss of faith. I think that's just the nature of starting from zero, and
you
kind of begin the process, and maybe you hit a wall, and you think, I think I misunderstood the kind of appeal of that.
Right.
But I think that's a natural I think it's a way that you're constantly testing the idea. Mm. And the fact is, in the beginning, you get started, your gun's blazing, you feel like it's the best idea in the world, and then something falls short, and you feel like, I guess maybe it's not such a good idea. And where it becomes important is to think, do you then give up, or do you push past that moment of doubt? I think it's important to understand that moments of doubt are common, and they aren't necessarily the sign that you should give up. I think what you try to develop is the instinct to know the difference between the usual moment of doubt that we all have, that happens when you encounter some off-putting kind of fact, versus this really isn't as good an idea as I thought.
Right.
That's a challenge.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, is there something anyone's told you or that you've come up with along the way? Anything you say to yourself during those moments that kind of snaps you out of a funk and gets you back on track? Or is it just you've done this and you know that this is all part of the process?
Well, I think it's mostly experience. I think I have learned through experience that it's very typical that at least a few times along the way, you're going to have your doubts.
Yeah.
Why are businesses like HelloVet choosing Apple products and services?
One of the great things about Apple products is that it's really easy for us to handle the security, the updates, the pre-installed applications. We've been able to do that without a dedicated IT support team.
Find out how Apple products and services can help you run your business at apple.co/HelloVet.
Usually, I think the best thing in those situations is give it a beat. Mm. Wait. See, try to analyze why you're losing your nerve. What is it? Is it that the idea is changing from what you first imagined? Changing is not bad. You know, you may initially feel like, wait a minute, this isn't the idea that I thought it was, but that's not reason to give it up. I think that's a reason to take a deep breath and say, all right, what I thought it was going to be isn't all that important. It's more important to see what it really is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Proceed with what it really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pause and take that beat and, you know, dig deep and figure out, am I losing nerve just because I'm feeling lazy? Which is a perfectly, you know, that happens all the time where you suddenly think, you know what, I don't really feel like writing a book. This is a lot of work. And maybe I just don't want to commit to such a big project. You may wait a beat and come out the other side and go, you know what, I really, truly don't want to do a book. Or you might think, I'm just feeling a little lazy right now.
Right. Well, I'd love to hear about your process because, as you said, you know, you're a business unto yourself. You're the boss. What is your process like? Do you have set hours? Do you write when inspiration strikes? How do you go about your day?
Well, my days are two very different profiles. I write nonfiction, so the initial part of my work is research, interviewing people, going to the library, reading the source material. And those are days in which I don't do any writing. I'm a researcher. I try to be pretty disciplined. I try to have a sort of task list for each day so I'm not just flailing wildly. And, you know, I try to think, all right, right now I'm researching this part of the topic, and I'll just go down that road and pursue it till I get to the very end and nail that down. So I try to be orderly. Keeping regular hours is less important to me than tasks. Like if I say I need to accomplish this task, I don't care how many hours it takes me. And, you know, I'm talking about having an ability to assess if a task is a day-long task, if it's a week-long task. You know, I think you need to have some sense about that. But I also like to be very open to the task growing. As I learn more about it, it becomes amplified by what I'm learning. So this goes on for months or years, depending on the topic. I've spent several years researching most of my books. They've just required that kind of work. And during that time, I've not written anything because my approach is to do all the research and then begin writing. I don't think, to me, it doesn't make sense to begin writing if I haven't learned the whole subject yet. So I'm first a student before I become the teacher. And I look at it very much in those terms, that I'm a student studying this topic for however long it takes, and then I become expert enough that I can become the teacher and teach the reader what I've learned. When it comes time to start writing, I have a very specific process of typing up all my notes, organizing them, transferring them onto index cards that to me are a very manageable way of keeping information organized. And then I start to write. When I write, I don't have a daily amount of time. I have a daily number of words.
What's the magic number?
The magic number is 1,000 words. And I try to write 1,000 words a day. And I'm very precise about it. And it's funny, it reminds me of when I was a runner and I would say, I'm going to run 3 miles. And I didn't run 2.5 miles. And I also didn't run 3.5 miles. I ran 3 miles. And right. It mattered to me to have a goal, to set it. I would be in a, you know, there's like an adrenaline flow that matches your goal.
Yeah.
You hit your goal. And, you know, if I was having a day where I was really in the groove, I would stay and write more. Of course, I didn't force myself to leave my desk.
Okay. Yeah.
But I felt that having a really specific goal for my productivity was incredibly important and helpful. And it sort of demystified the nature of, well, how much work am I going to get?
Yeah, done? Right.
I think it's very hard to not have some metric that's very concrete to say, today I'm going to write 1,000 words, rather than today I'm going to sit down and write my book. Well, right. No, you're not. You're not going to write.
Yeah, that's such great. I was going to ask you, how do you, you know, after years of gathering information, how do you organize it? How do you not look at this pile of stuff and get totally overwhelmed by it? And there's the answer.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that for nonfiction writers, learning how to manage the physical nature of what you're working on, the notes, the newspaper clips, the books, it's a big part of being successful. You need a system. And there are a number of different systems. I have one that I kind of developed more or less on my own. And whatever works for you, I think, is fine. But knowing that you cannot have a big mess of information and then every 5 minutes scrambling frantically
right,
to try to find that quote or that, you know, newspaper clip. I mean, you need to be very orderly when you're dealing with 4 or 5 years worth of research.
Now, to bring up a controversial two letters, AI, are you a do you see AI as a tool for helping writers collect and manage, or are you like AI is the devil?
I don't yet see how AI would help in that process of organizing and digesting information, partly because you don't want a shortcut. You want to read the whole interview, get all the good parts out, read the entire book that's relevant to your book, pull out the important parts. I don't trust AI. I don't want that pre-digestion. I want to do the digesting.
Right.
I want to be the intelligence. So, you know, there may, down the road, there may be applications that I don't yet know. But I think, you know, the thing that comes to mind immediately, saying to AI, summarize this book, well, to me, that's very dangerous because I'm supposed to be summarizing the book for the reader. If AI is summarizing it, well, then I might as well say to AI, just go ahead and write my book. I mean, that's the, you know, where I feel like it's a dangerous shortcut. And I'm not anti-technology. I feel like, you know, in many ways, it has opened the world of reporting, to be able to search the entire world, to search the libraries of the world. You know, of course, it's an incredible tool. Right now, though, I don't see the application for AI in the kind of work I'm doing.
You know, the world has, for journalists and writers, has changed quite a bit. AI is a part of that equation since, you know, since you started. And I'm sure you get asked a lot from aspiring journalists and aspiring writers, you know, these days, how do I get started? Like some of these, like alt weeklies and things like that don't really exist anymore. And they're not really a means of making a living. Like what's your advice when a young person asks you about that?
This is a really challenging question. And when I wrote Joyride, I didn't intend it to be nostalgic. And yet, you know, inadvertently, it captures an era that is largely gone or at the very least changed. And as I say, I started at Alt Weeklies. They are, I would say, 90% gone. I mean, when I was starting in my career, every city had an alt-weekly, and every city had two newspapers, and every newspaper had a Sunday magazine. You know, all of the places that I began my work. I wrote for a lot of women's magazines. I wrote for publications like Outside, and that, you know, are now a bare ghost of what they were. What do I tell young journalists? I mean, it's such a tricky thing because I don't want to be negative. I don't want to be pessimistic. But most of the advice I used to give to people is not applicable anymore. It's not actionable. People can't go get a job at an alt weekly. And that was very typically what I would say to people. Go to an alt weekly or go to a medium-sized city, get a job at the newspaper in a small and medium-sized city and write and write and write and write. So I still believe the most important thing is to write as much as you possibly can. The free platforms like Substack, which are often pointed to as the what has sprung up in the absence of alt weeklies and so forth, I actually don't think are the best place for a young writer to get started. I think it's really important to work with an editor, to get edited, to work to improve, to be vetted, to learn how to, you know, respond to assignments. The one thing I can say that has sprung up as the shrinking of the alt weekly and so forth, those worlds have shrunk, is that every publication now has a very big website. Mm. And lots of room on their websites to be filled. And that is where I see them bringing in young writers, that, you know, the landscape has really changed. And when I think of the New Yorker, you know, the New Yorker has a fixed number of pages in the print magazine. And those are fought over, you know, tooth and nail.
Right.
But then you've got this website that's so much bigger and is sort of infinitely expandable. And that is a path in that I think is really worth for young writers to go in through that door. Mm. And, you know, contribute to the website or angle to get a position on the websites and to work their way up from there.
Right, right.
But yeah. It's a tough landscape. I'm not going to lie. I think it is a challenging transformation that has made it harder to figure out how to get your toe in the door.
You know, speaking of the New Yorker, I watched this documentary about your time there called Adaptation. And it seems like you've done well. You've come out of your criminal past. So
yes.
Well done.
Yes, thank you. I feel much better now.
Have you had the experience of people like thinking that really happened to you?
Yeah, I would say in the beginning when the movie first came out, there were people who didn't get the joke and didn't understand the part of the movie that was completely fictitious and fantastical and, you know, the sort of fever dream of a Hollywood screenwriter. And in the very beginning, I was a little worried that people would actually make the mistake of thinking that had really happened.
Yeah.
It took some time, but I think, you know, the movie came out 20 years ago and it's become sort of iconic.
Yeah.
A commentary on sort of postmodern filmmaking. And I would say by and large, people sort of get it.
Right. Now, did you, when it was pitched to you or when you, I don't know what the process was like, if you saw a script first, but did you get it immediately or you were like, what is this?
No, I didn't get it immediately. All I knew was, I mean, my reaction was, I cannot risk being portrayed this way because people are going to, you know, think it's true. And it didn't matter to me that it was in the part of the film that becomes fictional, because I just thought people are going to see this and make an assumption that it really is true. And so my first reaction was, you know, you can't use my name. You're going to have to just use a pseudonym. I can't do this. And they were very disappointed and said, look, everyone's using their real name. All the people in the film are real. And it's part of the, joke, you know,
it's part of the
whole idea of the film. And I kept saying, no, you know, this is just professionally too big of a risk. And then, for reasons that I still don't totally understand, I changed my mind and said, okay, I'll do it.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, and part of your, the word risk, I mean, besides the time and energy that you put into all of your work, you know, you're not writing super straightforward reported pieces. Like, you are famous for some first lines that make your head snap when you read them for the first time. Was the first time you wrote an opening like that, was your stomach in a knot? Like, how is this going to be received? Or were you always confident?
You know, it's interesting. As you're saying that, I'm trying to think, what would I consider my first really good lead? And I would have to kind of go back and really look through my work. I've always cared a lot about my leads.
Can I read one of them to you?
Absolutely.
So this is your lead for The American Man. If Colin Duffy and I were to get married, we would have matching superhero notebooks.
Yes.
And that's your story about following a 10-year-old boy, right?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, that's an example where I wrote the lead and I should have been nervous, but I wasn't. I wrote it and I felt like it was exactly what I wanted to write. And I sort of plunged in and did the piece, turned it in through, I think, pure denial. I didn't let myself get nervous about it, where an editor could have been perfectly within their rights to come back to me and say, this is appalling. You know, you're a grown woman talking about being married to a 10-year-old boy. And I think that I have a certain ability to sort of separate myself from the kind of anxiety that you might have turning in a piece with a lead that might stop you in your tracks.
Right. Well, as a reader of yours, I'm glad that that duality in your brain exists, because it's always amazing reading of one of your pieces. I wondered if we could slide into the speed round of this conversation.
Of course.
So I'm going to hit you with a couple of quick questions. The first one being, what's better, the book or the movie?
Oh, the book.
Okay, got it. Good.
But you knew I was going to say.
Yeah. What is a habit that you are happy to have and one that you wish you could ditch?
I'm happy to have my discipline. I'm not sure if that's a habit, but it's a way of being disciplined. I would like to give up my habit of chewing huge amounts of gum while I'm writing.
Okay.
I think I've cracked my teeth.
Do you stick it under your desk, or what's the problem with too much gum?
You know, it's funny. I read recently that it supposedly really helps you concentrate.
Right.
And that, you know, kids are given gum when they're taking standardized tests and so forth. So maybe there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
But it felt like an addiction that I was chewing huge amounts of gum. And I thought, oh my God, I'm really like, if I don't have gum, I'm going to kind of panic and need to go to a dealer and get gum.
Well, what's your brand? I mean, maybe if you say it, the truck will show up at your house.
Yeah, Orbit.
Orbit. Okay. You heard it?
Peppermint.
Orbit people. Susan Orlean needs your help.
Yes.
what's your favorite way to turn off your brain?
Doing something physical. Cooking, gardening, going for a walk, going to the gym, and even something routine like ironing my clothes. I find just doing something physical, I can zone out. And I don't perseverate on things that I'm trying to write or things I'm trying to figure out. I actually get very emptied out and I'm not thinking. So it's hugely relaxing.
Is there anything that you like to watch or listen to that might surprise someone that this is a noted New Yorker writer, author of award-winning books? Anything, any silly, weird things that you like that people might not expect?
Well, I fall asleep each night to true crime podcasts.
Oh, okay.
My husband thinks I'm slowly going to become serial killer.
Right.
But I find it very relaxing.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm listening to this story of, you know, the husband who stabs the wife and sets her body on fire. And I'm like slowly drifting to sleep. It's very, very soothing.
You must have some interesting dreams.
Well, I've sometimes worried. I rarely remember my dreams. So let's keep it that way.
What you're capable of.
I know. I mean, I have a feeling it would give me really bad dreams, but I don't remember my dreams very often. So far, so good.
Finally, does listening to an audiobook count as reading?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, storytelling originated as an oral form, and writing down stories is really a much more modern invention. Listening to an audiobook is different from reading, but it absolutely counts as intake of a book. There is no question in my mind. And I've become an audiobook lover. And I will say, I know the differences. I know the ways in which reading affords you a certain exposure to the actual words that you don't get when you hear it audibly. But I have 100% taken in these books. And anyone who reads my books as an audiobook, I feel that they've, in a way, heard it in the most natural way imaginable, which is me telling them a story.
Oh, that's great. I love that. Well, so speaking of that, I want to remind everyone that Joyride is out now. And what's the best way for people to kind of keep up with you? Are you active? I know you're on Instagram. Are you active on that? Is that a good way to keep up with you?
Yeah, well, I have a Substack called Wordy Bird, and I'm on there pretty regularly. And I have my website, which is just susanorlean.com. And I am on Instagram with some regularity. You know, I check it all the time. I post when the mood strikes, but I'm definitely there and on Facebook.
Well, Susan, it's been so great talking to you and so great reading your work over the years. I can't wait. Now I can finally pick this back up and finish it. So I'm looking very forward to that.
Oh, well, this is such a pleasure. It was really nice talking to you, Dan.
We
We're right here for every catch-up between classes, for every personal best, for every ambition. Here at Canterbury Christchurch University, you're part of a vibrant community that celebrates every small win and every big moment. That's what makes us fifth in the UK for student experience, based on the Sunday Times Good University Guide 2026. Discover the degree for you at canterbury.ac.uk. Canterbury Christchurch University. We're right here with you.